This is the final one of the Director's Cut readings. The Director's Cut is a series running through Stanza 2010, and it's basically an indulgence for me as Festival Director, as this is my final year in the post. It comprises six readings and an exhibition. And if you've missed the other readings, I'm very sorry, you've missed some fine poetry, but you're in for some equally fine poetry today. Can I also give a mention to the exhibition that's part of the Director's Cut? That's Bridget Collins over in the Town Hall Foyer. A wonderful, wonderful exhibition full of fabulous visual realisations of poetry, ranging from Seamus Heaney to Basho, basically. Whole gamut there. The way I have chosen the poets for this series is I nominated six poets that I had never invited to Stanza, whom I really wished to hear at the festival before finishing as director. They read at the first three readings, and the second three readings are returnees, if you like, poets who've read previously or been at the festival in one capacity or another, and whose work I simply love. This is why the two poets are here for you today. Poets whose work really matters to me, really connects, and whose performances at Stanza I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. So it's a personal choice. What we have today is two poets who address that state of mind that I feel is really rather absent in the busy and celebrity-ridden world we live in, the state of wonder, two poets of wonder. Our first poet is Mario Petrucci. He's a scientist by training, and his poetry taps into science, but with that element of wonder attached to it. He writes verse of precision, verse of strength, verse of depth, and he's a wonderful reader of his poetry as well. So you're going to get a fantastic performance. Please give a good Stanza welcome to Mario Petrucci.
Lovely to be here, and thank you, Brian, for making me such a personal choice. I was wondering about the theme for these poems, and I came across something by Neruda where he says, "Love is short, but long in forgetting." And I think that's how most audiences want their poetry too. So what I was hoping to thread through all of these pieces was love in its variety of guises, love lost, love gained, the usual. But also love tempered and enriched by our consciousness of ecology and the environment. But always bearing in mind Oscar Wilde's warning that all bad poetry springs from genuine feelings. It's not common for men to write love poems to other men. And this first piece from Flowers of Sulphur is addressed to my grandfather, a man of runes and rituals. He'd lean over to me when I was a boy in Italy and say the most arcane things, such as, "You know, the blind man is never far from the gravy." Yes. Wanted to say something about grandfather. How one white afternoon under the vines, he stripped a cucumber with his penknife and offered. But my lecturer told us, "The edifice of consciousness needs a scaffold of knowledge." Though my grandfather said nothing, just walked ahead beneath a bladder rack of figs, whose rinsed greenish light made me gasp for brilliance. Then to a cove of starfish leaves, where he speared some underwater spicule-ed thing, a creature that had, it seemed, never proper sun, and paired it, alive, to near greenness in hands cured to leather by cigar smoke, the earth. Yet in me still, that bloodless child winks at the one full-lit dapple find in my face, at his need to shave a rind, strip by translucent strip, holding its last wet film up to light. That's it, grandfather. Making light of the knowing in his eyes, how he saw in me days broad as a noon-lit road where I see only a narrow past. That he held out this, his grandfather's seed, nerve in that flesh, running its length like a glyph through rock. each time I slice watercolour stars or strike a salad's strange mint of coins. In an earlier incarnation, I was a physicist and a physics teacher. Behind me in the lab, we used to have a chart showing all kinds of amazing facts about physics. And one of them was that we breathe, every time we take in a breath, innumerable molecules that Galileo had breathed. I wondered why it was just Galileo and not somebody else. And that, I was stunned by that. And somehow the fact that became the core of this poem about my alternative father, the one I never had, the coal miner whose lungs filled with coal black, rather as my real father's lungs filled with cancer. Lessons. Easy for me, your son, youthful lungs trawling in one sweep, cigar smoke, omelette, the girl next door. One day I told you how in physics we'd calculated a cough holds billions of atoms Galileo inhaled. It took a full week for your retort, as always off the nail. Must be I've used it all then, from Siberia to Antarctica, from slack pit to spire. That's why each draws so, so bloody hard. Your drenched face was me, silenced. Had to catch you last thing at the foot of your Jacob's ladder, ascending to the one bulb of the landing toilet, to tell you I checked with Sir. You can't use it all, I piped. Not in 100 million years. You'll get better. Just wait and see. Mouth bluish, a slur suspended over your chest, fist white on the rail. You said, don't hold your breath. It seems to me that some proper nouns are unlikely to be erased. Auschwitz to be one, and maybe Chernobyl is another. And I'm sure I don't need to detail in any way what happened at Chernobyl's fourth reactor back in April 1986. You'll have your own sense, I'm sure, of the human scale and cost of that tragedy. Just one fact, though, that brings it into some kind of embossed feel, I think, is 600,000 soldiers, chemists, engineers, firefighters were sent to the site over a period of months and years to clean up, and they were all horribly exposed. I'm going to read just two extracts from Heavy Water, the book on Chernobyl. These poems, I think both of them in their own ways, show how love is intensified by extremists. The first is the story of two lovers who meet just before the accident, and their love affair is interrupted but not annihilated by the calamity. And the second is the voice of the wife of one of the firefighters who was sent up onto the roof of the wrecked reactor to clear the debris by hand. And at that level of exposure, what happens to the body over a period of weeks and months is effectively it liquefies. One word. There was life, a life before. A girl of 16, a rigger of 24, meeting for cakes and nothing else. A girl who made herself late just to see what a handsome man waited for her. After work, beneath the clock, close by the post office, Volodarsky Street. And ah, that night they shared champagne and madeleines under stars in Gorky Park, until their hands gravitated and both dared whisper, yes, yes, they said, then touched lips as though it were some law of physics. 1 year together, before finally they kissed and nothing more. Who would believe it? Who would change a breath of it, even if a voice of doom boomed in from the planets? Every day I found a new man, Ludmila Ignatenko. Do not kiss him, they said, starting back as though he were an animal in its cot, cocking its head to listen, but understanding nothing. Do you understand? Are you pregnant? No. And find him milk 3 liters a day. I poured that whiteness into him, felt I was feeding a goose its own feathers. He retched and cursed, the thin dribble each side of his mouth worse than a child. Each time you hold his hand is a year off your life. Can you hear us? His bones are more active than the core. Understand, that is no longer your husband. I boiled chickens until the bones sagged. Fresh handfuls of parsley, chopped so fine it would melt between finger and thumb. Pot barley, apples from Michelinsk, they told me. Pared and pulped, everything minced and sieved. Every trace of rind and pip removed. No husk, shell or pod, and all of it spewed back down his chest, as though he could not take a single particle more. The black of his forearms and thighs cracked like pastry. His eyelids swelled so tight with water he could not see for skin. The lightest sheet peeled away fat as flypaper. The slightest edge of thumbnail was to him more vicious than any cutthroat. If I moved his head, it streaked hair down the pillow, as though he were a used match. If I pressed a knuckle in, our wedding flesh, the indent remained like hot grey putty. He coughed bile, acid froth and lung, shreds of stomach and liver, and still he stayed. Refused that first, that last step onto the Jacob ladder. Those reptile eggs of eyelids turned always towards me. Until I said, go, I love you, but go. Up to that moment, I still believed I would save him. Milk, soup, kisses, as if he could digest the touch of my lips, feel my making of broth in his dissolving heart chambers. When his breath shut, when he began to call, then I called for family. It was almost a miracle, the doctors said. 4 times the fatal dose, and he nearly turned round. I felt myself the wrong side of a door, a partition thin as plywood, thinner, as though you could hear everything that was going on inside. His mother hugged me. The brothers kissed me. Now we are your brothers. Have you ever been the wrong side of that door? Knowing all you needed was the key and you could walk straight in. That's how it was. We were that close. After those 4 poems, I feel I want to move to a more celebratory register. This is my most recent book, just 2 weeks old, still in its diapers, still keeping me up at night, I, Tulips, very much takes its cues from American modernism, the Black Mountain poets, the projectivists. There's more than a whiff of William Carlos Williams that's informed these, I feel, and a bit of Stevens maybe at the back, and Rilke lurking. It's a sequence I started some years ago, about 2005, and it's already 800 poems strong, so it's really seized me. And I don't know quite how to talk about them. I just want to say something, though, for a minute or two. If I had the breath of a whale, I'd try to read each of these poems without pause, because they're written, each of them, as an unpunctuated gesture, and that's how they sit on the page. They all have a family likeness in terms of form and tone, and that shape, beveled tercets mostly. And each of them attempts, as those American modernists did in different ways, to address the moment they find themselves in, rather than the moment reconstructed post hoc. I feel that they're my own expedition into language, an attempt to trust language and poetry mid-stride. And two quotes that I feel have been at the back of this all the time, helping me. One was by Frost, where he speaks of language caught alive. And the other, somebody you may not have heard of, Michael Davidson, who wrote an introduction on the Objectivist, saying language as participant in thought. So some of them sound very conventional, and everything I've said will probably be irrelevant in that respect, and others don't. And perhaps they have to come into a space like this as an impressionistic set of words and phrases that just wash through you and leave you with an overall tone and mood. And the last thing I want to say, perhaps, is they also stand against the idea that experimental poetry is tantamount to difficult poetry. I don't believe that. And also the sense that difficult means it can't be moving. I don't believe that either. All the poems I'm going to read from are from the first section of the book that's about 24 hours in Commuter Love Affair. It has an Aristotelian unity to it because it's set in the day and a night. There's a row that's occurred at some point, and there's an empty house with just a homeopathic presence of the beloved who's departed in it. But really, these poems, if they're about anything, it's the intimacies of love and language. Let us talk lip to lip, as though morning just made us, parted these mouths, worn as clay, to make way for words that are for us to try, first time on air, deft as dew on its leaf. So let me speak as an Adam might, whose moment is under a kind God, who looks on a half-made garden, and come evening will change his mind. This light shows through you as dusk where you turn, addressing, addressed by our window, as though you wore galls of being here more lightly when I yearn through you for light beyond you. Yet I learn the firmest sight can hold onto tonight is that shaping and shaped by almost here. Fern-coloured dress. These two poems from My Tulips look at how science and love meld. And I think one of the reasons I write poetry more than prose, and this is being unfair on prose, is the way in which poetry can do two or more things at once. And these poems, I think, do that. The first is looking at the stages of the embryo, and how, before we're even born, we rehearse in the womb all the forms that our species has evolved. And just seeing that in time lapse, as one does these days, is, again, incredible. One of the great things that science has done for us, to give us new forms of imagery. And the second poem is quantum physics, and how I feel that sometimes we jump between emotional states. We don't glide from one to the other. Everyone begins as fish and ends so, spiralling after egg, that other half of our chains, and setting gills in gristled knot that buds legs as tadpoles do, and blowhole ears halfway down the back, and low-set eye, alien as featherless chick. Ah, we have peered into that shared ovum whose blastoflesh runs its gauntlet of fowl and fish, so fused that the tale nothing can be told apart. Is this why, when I am late, I find in upstairs dark you on placenta duvet and hunched round self as wombed ones are, as though I had just returned from eternity to catch you? Naked, out, sleepwalking space, without even navel twisted, purpled rope to hold you. Between, as each lot of room is breathed now between us, or as each will break breath willingly across its supple back to kiss. Or that vow I lifted, tureen heavy and precarious, offered to you who never did ask. Or that time driving through dark on the verge of irretractable words, when half of forest leapt to its other as quantum bolt of stag. This poem is predicated on one of those things you find that you have to write about. It was, I can't even remember where I found it. It was a quote from one of the African states where love is spoken about in terms of pillows. The different varieties of love are how many pillows, where the pillows are situated, and who's holding them. And this worked its way into a poem that's much more at that other end of the spectrum I was referring to earlier, the impressionistic end. It's really a jazz piece on love and my own personal and the universal inputs into the language of love. So it's love speaking and love being addressed. Love sends itself flowers and mails its single-stemmed blood down the spinal telegraph, all petal and thorn, and never signs the card. Oh, I stand at the delivery ajar and wondrous at my syncopating lobes as rhythm love swells down there to the one old tune. Work it out, head puffs, work it out, that pencil-biting maths of trouser and gusset forged in the belly furnace, those matching sets of differentials yielding smaller version selves. Such noble illusions I have borne through changeling vein, Azelian, Sumerian, Cretan, Egyptian, Navajo, Greco-Roman, all the one difference. Through China, Belgium to Mesoamerica, I crossed burning and spurned bridges and crossed myself pons pubis to pons cranium, spanned with that smile I cannot put on, for she who gave speech in chocolate-sized pieces gave speech me, gave speech you. O Prometheus, bind me in my red room on this red mountain. Bind me to tell through the liver each form of love. For there is married love, and married love with a pillow, and married love with pillows for head and foot, and married love with the pillow between, and the woman with six children and pillow, and the man who has come to woman who has a husband to ask for a pillow, and three men who seek the same married pillow. These are the forms whose words have quarrelled with pillows between. For illusion excels, as I say, its three words over and out with a voice print computers can register grimly. O love, you have sent appeasing flowers, and that delivery tries every address down my spine. But I grow closer in calculating who sends. I'm singling you out by elimination, can nibble your edges, O love, earlobe viced between my lips, those fluttering hands clamped at my brow, your bracing breath upon my instruments. I have you, a hatchling in my palm. I have you, as you were when you began, and soon means to determine your flight, to release when you suit me, for I would go naked, though not through Eden, though not in the head, and so will take you while you are going, take you while you are going, fast, take you three in a bed with knowing, but then, what one dressed, what, thrust in luck, I can still peel you back to climb in beside myself, to slide, yes, slide into love, full clothed. Let me finish on an altogether different note. Britain, the year 3900, globally warmed, agrarian, low tech, rains almost as much as it does in Scotland. Wetter than Noah's armpits. No oil, no gas, no coal. Perhaps our current problems war, collapse of ecology and so on are caused as much by a lack of imagination as anything else. And we have so many apocalyptic poems about the future. And in this imagined future, I wondered how the human spirit would survive, how it would thrive telling tall tales by dropping half-empty buckets into wells of metaphor. And with so much lost, with so much squandered by previous generations, so much would be regained. And there would still be, I feel, an urgency for imagination, a need for stories, and a primal love of language. So I imagine myself as a 12-year-old in the year 3900. In hay waist deep was uncle who said he saw lash of rain snap upward, viper sharp, to bite the coming down tail. Another, tending eaves from top-notch ladder, felt on his back drops worse than wasps to a sack, while wife with foot hard on bottom rung kept her face of tinder. Yet another watched brown slick of cloud a few metres up suck back its centre like a seam in the roasted bean till it split with blue, and for an hour all air smelt of coffee. Last it came to me. I said, once I stood in rain so ferocious, streams front and back, down shallow contour of nipples and ravine, between each half of arse, met at my pizzle, till I knew to my balls how it felt to piss like Orion. I said this happened, but they laughed and took out scythes and said the hay was dry enough. Thank you very much.